Hello, I'm Rob Matheson, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, what's the price of rebuilding Ukraine, and who are going to be the real winners? Also this week, almost 830 million people around the world went hungry in 2021, and that number is rising. Why is the world moving backwards as it tries to eliminate hunger and malnutrition? Plus, Zimbabwe's currency crisis is getting deeper. Why have people lost confidence in banks and the economy? Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says he thinks it's going to cost $750 billion to rebuild his country after the war. Now, even as the fighting continues, Western leaders from dozens of nations, international organizations and the private sector have been talking about how to rebuild Ukraine. Many say Ukraine needs another Marshall Plan. That was a huge economic rescue deal that was devised by the US to rebuild Europe after World War II. Now, the challenge of rebuilding a nation after a conflict is complex. Businesses and politicians have a crucial role to play. Billions of dollars are at stake. Researchers at the World Economic Forum say private investors going into a war-torn country need a positive business case for investing in unstable, conflict-ridden places. They'd be looking for a functioning state with working institutions able to give sustainable investment. Investors often have skills and experiences that can support governments shattered by fragility and conflict. There would need to be opportunities for public-private partnerships to kick-start growth and work together. Citizens and local businesses must be part of the plans. And backers from outside can help foster transparent and efficient money management practices. Well, joining us from Stockholm is Torbjörn Becker. He's the director of the Stockholm Institute of Transition Economics, and he's also a board member of the Kiev School of Economics. So thank you very much indeed for being with us. So the World Economic Forum has produced a long list of requirements that investors would need to be in place before they would move into a country like Ukraine to start rebuilding. That's a long list to tick off, isn't it? How tough is that going to be?
Well, it's going to be tough for Ukraine as for any other countries that comes out of a situation like this, obviously. And I think we have to remember all of these lists have to start with some level of security in Ukraine. So some sort of end to the aggression from Russia needs to be the starting point for most of these investments to come, I would think.
Rebuilding Ukraine makes for great publicity. But politicians are likely to be using taxpayers' money. Private investors are going to be looking to make some sort of profit. In terms of the practicality of doing something like this, going on past experience, how likely is it that Ukraine is actually going to get the rebuilding support that it believes that it needs?
Well, it's going to require a lot of strong reform efforts. I think the first step has already been taken with the EU accession process getting off the ground pretty well last couple of weeks. We also have very strong support from international leaders that will help Ukraine to move along on that path. But of course, there's a lot of issues to be dealt with on the road ahead.
In terms of the actual investment itself, how could companies and indeed governments, because as I say, they're using taxpayers' money, be guaranteed that the money that they're investing is actually going to be used in the projects that they believe it is going to be? We have seen historically in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and other crisis hit areas in the past where the amount of money that's invested isn't actually the amount of money that gets on the ground. Is there a facility for creating some sort of guarantee?
Well, I think rebuilding some of the institutions that deal with corruption and rule of law is already on the short list of things and priority list of things to do for the Ukrainian government. And I think this will be key to this. I also think we have to remember that Ukraine is a democratic country that I think has become much more united in this war. So I think there will be a much more strong sense of common purpose and direction in the whole country compared to some of the cases you just mentioned, where it was much more fractionalized in terms of the domestic politics. So in that sense, I think Ukraine has better hopes of making this a successful rebuilding process.
One of the things that we've seen in the past when there's been investment like this is that countries go in on the stipulation that any work that is done within the country actually goes to companies within those countries. So essentially the money becomes a cycle. It goes into those companies, but it then goes back to the original country. Who do you think are going to be the financial winners out of any rebuilding plan for Ukraine?
Well, I mean, that's hard to discuss, I guess. But I mean, I think the international community has a strong common interest to make sure that the winners of this is going to be the people of Ukraine and not our specific companies that we want to support. I mean, there's a long history of talking about untied aid, for example, where we do not support our individual countries from, let's say, Sweden or the UK or wherever the country money is coming from. So I think this will also be important here. So the international community needs to do its homework on governance and anti-corruption as well as the Ukrainian side.
Is there any mechanism within, say, I don't know, the World Bank, for example, any global mechanism that could oversee the level of investment and the money that is going into Ukraine to try to keep track of what is being put in place?
Well, I mean, you're mentioning the World Bank, which, of course, is an important international player. I think given the EU accession process, I think the EU needs to be very heavily involved in this. Von der Leyen has said that they are setting up a platform to coordinate donors. So I think something like that will be needed to really help Ukraine coordinate the outside world and make sure that these issues of transparency and anti-corruption is dealt with properly.
There has been a lot of discussion about whether or not Russia should be made to pay for some of the rebuilding process. How likely do you think that is, and how would you enforce it?
I think there is plenty of Russian assets that are seized outside of Russia's border. But of course, there will be probably very long legal processes to make a transfer of those assets to Ukraine. So in terms of time horizon, I'm not sure when that money could be made available to Ukraine, but it's going to take a lot of legal processing, I'm sure.
Part of the conflict has seen a lot of damage done to small and medium businesses within inside Ukraine. And as is commonly said, small and medium businesses are often a driving force for any country's economy. What is the risk, do you think, that the rebuilding projects that are going to happen in Ukraine are going to be on the larger scale, and the small and medium business sector is going to miss out?
Well, I think it would be quite natural if small and medium-sized enterprises become subcontractors to a lot of these processes. So I really don't see that as something for them to miss out on. But I mean, it's also going to depend on what kind of skills they have in those businesses. So maybe part of the solution will be retraining some of the people that have been working in other sectors in the past to be part of the reconstruction process.
Torbjörn Becker is director of the Stockholm Institute of Transition Economics. So we appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The United Nations says nearly 830 million people around the world went hungry in 2021, and that number is set to rise this year. In low-income countries, where agriculture is key to the economy, livelihoods have been affected by the impact from COVID-19 and rising global inflation. Let's look at Syria, for example, where wheat is an essential crop in a deteriorating economy. Now, many depend on bread as their main source of food. Our correspondent, Zeynep Khodr, explains how farmers in the northwest who are struggling with drought and high production costs are becoming increasingly dependent on imports of grain.
Before the uprising in 2011, Syria was able to feed itself. But years of war and now a severe drought has made this nation a net importer of wheat.
Over the past 2 to 3 years, the whole country has been hit by a crippling drought that its impacts are felt mostly in the northeast, which is traditionally the breadbasket of the country, let alone areas that are in the northwest of the country or regime-held areas.
The rise in global prices sparked by Russia's invasion of Ukraine is threatening food supplies to many people in Syria. The country is among the 10 most food insecure nations in the world. 12 million people struggle to get enough food. Many of them live in the opposition-controlled north.
We have limited incomes, and yet we have to rely on expensive imported wheat because much of the land in this region is mountainous. We can't grow much wheat.
And lands where wheat can be grown are not accessible. Vast areas were set on fire by government forces during the conflict, and irrigation channels were destroyed. And even though there is now less violence, front lines still exist.
We are close to the regime positions. Many people can't reach their land because it is dangerous.
Humanitarian organizations, as well as the local authorities, are helping farmers to produce more food. But it's costly to plant crops, so is transporting the harvest due to high fuel prices. Fuel is also needed to pump groundwater to make up for what is being described as Syria's worst drought in 70 years. In the opposition-held area in the north, production won't be enough.
This year, 30,000 hectares were cultivated, but the low rainfall and high production costs hurt farmers. A ton of wheat costs $450. We will have to import more than 30,000 tons this year.
The average annual amount of wheat production before the war was 3.7 million tons. This declined to 1.8 million tons between 2015 and 2019. Harvests are shrinking, and farmers are fighting to survive. And with more than half of Syria's people already hungry, the agricultural crisis couldn't come at a worse time. Zana Khudr, Al Jazeera.
Well, Cindy Holloman is a senior economist of food security and nutrition in the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. She's joining us now from Rome. Thank you very much indeed for being with us. What is driving food insecurity?
There's about four major drivers that we've been analyzing that is leading to this uptick in hunger that we're observing. One is conflict. So conflicts are becoming more protracted and complex. And then we have new conflicts like the war in Ukraine. A big one also is climate extremes, climate variability, extreme heat, flooding, storms. This extreme climate weather is also creating havoc in terms of production prices, and that's a big driver in terms of food insecurity and hunger. And then the third one, which is actually more growing in prominence, is the economic slowdowns and shocks, whether it's caused by the COVID pandemic and the measures put in place, which disrupts supply chains, people lose their incomes. So these economic shocks really create a big problem for people to access food. So those are the three big drivers. And then the other one that's very important is inequality. So we see that while poverty has been going down in the last few years, high income equality or inequality in terms of access to services like health or basic services in terms of sanitation and everything, or is unequal. So this high inequality is also a big driver behind food insecurity. So when you get these shocks, like an economic shock, an economic downturn, a market price increase, where there's countries that have high inequality, we see that the effects are much greater.
Mm. What are the countries around the world that are being hit hardest by this?
Well, I think, the COVID pandemic, we saw, the largest global recession that we've seen in a long time. And so we saw hunger increase and food insecurity increase in every country around the world. So that was quite a major shock. If we look at the number of people that are hungry, our latest estimates show that since 2019, before the COVID pandemic, 150 million more people are hungry. So it did affect every country around the world. However, we do see hunger is increasing faster in Africa. The percent increase is the higher.
This isn't just about low-income countries. Have you been talking about this is hitting all parts of the world? Are there any areas which have surprised you, which you wouldn't normally expect to have been affected by this, that have actually been had an impact?
Well, I think, for the results we're seeing, everybody expects, the bad news about Africa. It is got the fastest growing number of people that are hungry It has got droughts, it's got conflict, it's got economic shocks, you know, high levels of inequality. I think that's kind of expected, but I think what's unexpected is the high levels of food insecurity increasing in Latin America. So if we look at Latin America, the increases, there's been doubling in terms of food insecurity since 2015. We also see, you know, rising levels of obesity and overweight, which is also a very big problem in terms of malnutrition. It's a part of nutrition that's critical for people's productivity, for their health. And we see that increasing around the world. And it's related to the high cost of nutritious foods. Mm.
If I understand it correctly, the worldwide financial support for farmers is about $630 billion. And the UN has said that a lot of that doesn't even get as far as the farmers. What kind of impact does that have? And why is that happening?
If you look at the support, the $630 billion, most of it goes toward trade barriers, price incentives. And it's very focused on staple crops, dairies and meat, while vegetables and fruits and more healthier items are also penalized or even discouraged from production. So we are also calling for a relook at how governments are spending their money. A healthy diet is 5 times more expensive than a basic energy diet on staples.
Cindy Holloman, we really appreciate you being with us on Al Jazeera. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Zimbabwe is battling hyperinflation, which has led to a loss of public confidence in banks and conventional pension systems. Many are now looking for safer ways to protect their investments. Adam Matasa reports from Norton, where cattle have become a safer option than the local currency.
With inflation nearly reaching 192% in June, and Zimbabwe's dollar fast losing its value, investing in cattle has become a safer option for some people here than the local currency, an investment they can see and trust.
They obviously choose how many units they want to invest in. It's all Zimbabwe dollar related investment. There's 13,000 units available for investment. One unit is equal to 100 kgs of live cattle.
The expectation is that the price, the value of the cattle, appreciates in time, unlike Zimbabwe's dollar. And if clients want to get paid out, their investments are valued and they get their cash back.
For people in Zimbabwe and other African nations, cattle have long been a source of wealth. In many rural areas, they are used as currency to pay school fees. Now, similar schemes are being offered to people in urban areas.
Like any investment, there are risks. Animals can get sick and die from drought and diseases, but there are also ways to increase their potential.
When they drop their offerings, or that they give birth to the young ones, that's your interest rate. It's a better bank than going to the bank and putting money and get eroded by inflation. So it's a better investment opportunity.
Asset managers say more Zimbabweans are looking for ways to protect their savings against inflation as the economy struggles to rebound.
I think it'll gain traction, and we're very excited for it. We want this to be the thrust of starting to develop the national herd and get back into exporting of beef, and that'll all just support the local industry.
For now at least, cattle seem to be a more stable currency than the local currency, one way of trying to preserve investment value in a country where some citizens have lost faith in conventional methods. Hadi Mutasa, Al Jazeera, Norton, Zimbabwe.
From Johannesburg, I'm joined now by Yvonne Mohango. She's the Managing Director and Head of the Africa Research Economics at Renaissance Capital. Very good to have you with us here. Inflation's now hit 800% in 2020. It's at 131.7% in May. How bad is this going to get, do you think?
Well, I think there's certainly more upside. So yes, we have seen inflation creep up. We saw it come down last year to around 50% year on year in the middle of the year, and then start to pick up once again as the currency came under pressure. So the most recent print is 192% for June, and that reflects the depreciation that the currency has been coming under. To your question, I continue to see further upside risk to inflation, and that's in part due to quasi-fiscal operations at the central bank that is putting the currency under pressure, and in addition to that, of course, the spike in commodity prices.
Okay, let's talk about what the central bank is doing. Why is that having an impact on the currency?
Well, we're in a situation whereby the government is constrained in terms of financing, and that's related to the fact that the country is officially under debt distress, which of course limits their access to external financing. So in a situation that presents itself as currently, whereby the government is constrained on the fiscal front, you do find that the central bank is stepping in and having a quasi-fiscal role, essentially, which includes monetizing the budget deficit. That, of course, is adding to the inflationary pressures that we are seeing.
Also being blamed, I believe, are COVID-19 and the Ukraine war. I can understand what you're talking about in terms of the central bank. How do those other two factors play into this?
COVID, as you can imagine, the government expenditure had to pick up, particularly on the health side, in terms of containing the effect of the pandemic and also providing measures to try and support households and businesses that had been impacted by the pandemic. So that, of course, pushed up spending. And now we have the Ukraine invasion, which has, of course, resulted in prices of fuel and food, including fertilizers, picking up. The government of Zimbabwe does subsidize inputs into the agriculture sector, including fertilizer. So that's putting upward pressure on spending. And as I mentioned earlier, the government is constrained in terms of financing. They don't have the options of external financing that other countries that are more creditworthy do. So you do find that the central bank does step in and monetizes the budget deficit.
I want to ask you about the role of the central bank in this, because it's being accused of actually creating the situation in the first place by essentially printing lots of cash when it was being advised by economists not to do so. Is that a fair accusation, do you think?
That is part of the problem. To be fair, on the fiscal side, at least, the authorities have tried to maintain a very small deficit because of concerns around financing that particular budget deficit. But given the constraints that not just Zimbabwe, but several African countries have faced during the course of this pandemic, the central bank has had to step up in terms of quasi-fiscal activities. In addition, you have a situation that whereby the official currency exchange rate is overvalued. It's sitting at around 380 Zimbabwean dollars to the US dollar. And you compare that to the parallel market exchange rate, which is at over 600 to the US dollar. So that is also part of the problem that the authorities are currently managing an overvalued exchange rate, which is putting pressure on the parallel market rate to depreciate.
One of the things that we quite often see in situations like this in other countries around the world is that you end up with two markets. You end up with one with the official currency, and of course you end up with a black market, in this case possibly US dollars. Is that what's happening in Zimbabwe?
That's exactly what's happening, and unfortunately it does imply a transfer subsidy. So essentially what happens is exporters who are asked to surrender their proceeds at an overvalued rate, as well as those buying dollars on the parallel market, are subsidizing those that can access dollars at the official market. And that's the situation we are seeing now in Zimbabwe.
If the US dollar still has such a grip in Zimbabwe, do you think that there's any mileage in the country returning to using the US dollar? Do you think that the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa would actually be open to that idea?
I think we're already moving towards a more dollarized Zimbabwe, similar to what we had between 2009 and 2019, because essentially what's happening is the Zimbabwean dollar, as you know, a currency is meant to be a store value, a medium of exchange and unit of account. And if for people to have confidence in the currency that currency has to hold value. And that's not the case currently in Zimbabwe. So yes, currency does tend to depreciate over time due to inflation, but the rate at which the Zimbabwe dollar is experiencing inflation is resulting in such a huge loss of confidence. And you are seeing Zimbabweans and residents seeking alternative sources, including these gold coins that have been introduced in order to try and just hold value in terms of assets.
Mm. Yvonne and Margaret, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is our show for this week. But remember, you can get in touch with us via Twitter. Use the hashtag AJCTC when you do drop us a line, or you can drop us an email. Our address is countingthecost@aljazeera.net. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That's going to take you straight to our page, which has got individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Rob Matheson. From the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.